And we return. It is today's Topical Currents on this beautiful Tuesday afternoon. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Today we focus on anxieties and how they affect children, parents, and families. We'll visit with the co-authors of Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, 7 Ways to Stop the Worry Cycle and Raise Courageous and Independent Children. First, it's Dr. Reed Wilson. He's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina. And Dr. Wilson joins us from Chapel Hill. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Thanks, Joseph.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Sure.
There we go.
Hey.
There we go.
Thank you.
Loud and clear now.
Bonnie, you speak up too.
Yes, okay, I will.
Okay, good.
Now, don't cause any anxiety for me here.
No.
Okay. Sure. Also with us is licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist Lynn Lyons. She specializes in anxiety disorders and joins us from Concord, New Hampshire. Welcome to you, Dr. Lyons.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Good to have you both. So you have a combined 50 years of experience and you've seen an upswing in anxiety among children. How has that increased and over what time period are we talking about?
Well, anxiety's increased in adults as well as kids. This is a global village now. We hear about everything all over the world. And kids vary. One of the troubles we had about after 9/11 is if the child's young enough and they're watching TV and you see the towers falling again, they keep thinking another building is falling. So when we allow children to hear all that they hear about the stresses and troubles in the world, then they're naturally going to be more anxious. And we as parents and adults are, if I don't know how old you two are, but I'm old enough to remember driving around in my dad's car, sitting in his lap and no seatbelts and so forth. Today, we're so much more careful with the possibility that our kids are going to get injured or stolen, so forth. So I think a lot of this is coming out of this communication of scary things all over the world.
I guess you never wore a helmet on your bicycle.
Oh, no. No, I don't even know that we could have gotten them back then. But, of course, that was 1845, and those bikes were really tall back then.
Well, okay, I don't know which one of you to ask, but how does anxiety present itself in a child? Like, what are the most common symptoms? And are we talking about crippling anxiety now, panic attacks and crippling disorders? Or are we talking about just normal anxiety? And Lynn Lyons, I'll give that to you.
Okay. Well, so anxiety is normal. It's a part of the human experience when you're stepping into something new, something unfamiliar, something a little overwhelming. We're designed to feel anxiety. That's our body's system saying, hey, slow down, take your time, think this through. So we don't want to tell kids, give the kids the message, or give the parents the message that you shouldn't feel any anxiety. When it becomes crippling is when children start to avoid things that are developmentally appropriate, because avoidance works. So if you feel anxious and your goal is to avoid that feeling, then you're going to stop going to birthday parties, you're going to stop going to sleepovers, you're not going to try out for the soccer team, you might even try to avoid going to school or at least riding the bus to school. So when we're talking about crippling anxiety, crippling may even be too strong a term, although it can become crippling. Mm-hmm. We're really looking at the type of anxiety that's getting in the way of kids learning, growing, taking risks, experimenting, failing. And the way it's going to present is certainly with a lot of physical symptoms. Younger kids in particular are going to have stomach aches, tummy aches. They're going to talk about not feeling well, headaches. They're going to talk about not wanting to do something because it's boring or because they're tired or they don't want to. Just a lot of avoidance, a lot of stepping back instead of stepping in.
It's interesting, once they start to get to be teenagers, they're quieter about this the teenager tends to have more worry inside their mind, and they don't talk about it as much. So there is a kind of transformation that takes place in a lot of the kids as they begin to grow older.
I guess they get a little more wily about covering up these anxieties.
Well, they do,
right.
And as what Lynn was saying, is that they begin to say, you know, I don't really care about the soccer team anymore, or, you know, I never really wanted to try out for cheerleaders, and I just did last year, and I'm done with that. So they have a way of dismissing things as, I'm not interested. It's a way of saving face. So, but that's one of the cues that parents want to be looking for. Are they starting to back away? And if it's not really transparent, where the child's saying, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to throw up on the bus, if it's just backing away a little bit, for some of these kids it's going to be more depression, but for others it can be based on fear and anxiety.
It must be a difficult call for a parent to know when treatment is required, because it seems like there's a fine line between, and then sometimes the children hide it, as you say, and it might be hard for them to know when their child actually is in danger of, you know, really coming under the spell of a very, very bad anxiety disorder.
Yeah, and I think that the things that bring parents into see me the most, so maybe the family is kind of managed with this anxiety, maybe the parents are anxious themselves, because statistically that's a pretty good likelihood, and everybody's been kind of able to keep the train on the tracks because they're avoiding this, and maybe they're accommodating over here. The things that, the two main reasons that families will call me is when sleep becomes an issue, because everybody's tired and an anxious kid won't go to bed or is up during the night, and also then when the school starts to notice academic concerns, or when the child won't stay in school or can't get the child into school. Mm. So those are the two things that kind of tend to be the tipping points for parents in making that phone call.
What happens to a kid who has some real anxieties and fears, and yet he's stuck with a parent that has sort of the great Santini attitude of toughen up, you know, let's go out and get him?
Well, and you actually do see that, and one of the things that we talk about, one of the risk factors for anxious kids continuing to be anxious is that parent. There's really two types of parents in these situations. One is the one that accommodates the child and feels bad for the child, maybe is anxious themselves, and the world's a scary place and you better be careful. And so what that parent starts to teach the kid is, listen to me, I'll tell you what to do, here are the rules, and you know, now you'll be safe. The other is what you're talking about, Joseph, which is the more critical, irritated, you know, tough it out kind of parent. And that parent also is saying, listen to me, and I'll tell you how you need to behave. What we see in the child is what we call external locus of control. They start paying attention to what the parent wants instead of what they want, and then they become even more anxious and unclear about what their needs are. And, of course, the critical parent is intimidating for the kid, and it tends to have that paradoxical effect. The more, as you were saying, the father is pushing them, the more they tend to withdraw, and then all those tensions in the family just build and build. Very often, the critical parent withdraws from the scene, and who's left is the anxious child and the anxious parent, and that's not a very good combination.
It occurs to me many parents may be unaware of their own fears and anxieties, and they had gone untreated for them, and therefore they just project them onto their children. How can that be avoided?
Well, you're right, and I have to say that probably at least 50% of the time when I'm sitting with a child who's come to see me for help with their anxiety, and I'm explaining how anxiety works and giving them all the information that they need, the parent will say, oh, if only I had had this information when I was 12, or if only somebody had told me when I was throwing up by the mailbox waiting for the bus every morning, if only somebody had explained to me how to handle these feelings and that this was anxiety. So that really is a problem. The other problem is that anxious parents have a really hard time trusting that letting go is a good thing. And they don't want any risk to step into their role as parents. They want to keep their children safe. So it's really hard. You have to be pretty persuasive and also pretty gentle with these parents and saying, look, we need to equip you and your child with the skills that you need to step into the world. And the idea that you're going to be able to protect your child from everything, not only is that unrealistic, but it's harmful. Your child's not going to develop the problem-solving skills that they're going to need to tolerate uncertainty, to take reasonable risks. But when you've got a parent who's very committed to their anxious way of viewing the world, it's hard for them to let that go because it just feels so risky.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
if we have a soapbox that we stand on, it's this idea, which is we're not here to say, let me teach you how to fix Johnny or Janie. But very often, if you're an anxious parent, you actually have to do some fixing of yourself too.
Right.
And that's part of what we're trying to address. It's like what we know is kids who are anxious, 65% of those kids who are anxious have a parent in the house who's diagnosable. And so the parent actually does need to look at himself or herself in that situation.
We're speaking about anxiety today and how to stop the worry cycle and raise courageous and independent children. Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, the name of the book, by Dr. Reed Wilson and Lynn Lyons. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to open the phones when we come back and take your call. Stay with us. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking about Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, Seven Ways to Stop the Worry Cycle and Raise Courageous and Independent Children with co-authors Dr. Reed Wilson and Lynn Lyons. If you have a familial experience with anxiety or you're anxious, children, whatever the case, you can call us and join in if you have a question or comment. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576 or email radio@wlrn.org.
Is there an environmental aspect to this or a genetic aspect? I mean, sometimes you'll see a kid who has a lot of anxiety and they have siblings who are raised in the same environment, and the siblings aren't that way.
Well, we have what we call temperament, and we're not really clear why, you know, even with twins, sometimes one is different than the other. But what we see in temperament is what we call behavioral inhibition. These kids, as infants, are easily startled. They get scared easily, they withdraw, they don't like seeing a new face, even a new toy is tough. They're much more vigilant about the possibility of threats, and that is a setup, a precursor for kids who end up being more anxious. So there is a genetic component. We know there's no anxiety gene, but it's what we would call risk factors. And of course, one of the risk factors is having an anxious parent as well.
Well, how does one know? I mean, I would think there's therapy for this and there's also medication. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so
yep,
how do...
both.
Go ahead.
Well, so my approach, and I think that Reed would agree with this, is if you can give kids and families tools, you really can make a big difference in the way that they manage anxiety. One of the reasons I like to treat anxiety disorders is because they're so darn treatable. Medications can help, but with kids that come to see me that aren't on medication, that haven't gone to see their pediatrician or haven't gone to see their family practitioner, I'm going to urge that they learn the tools first and that we give it a good 3 or 4 or 5 months of really learning some concrete skills that we know help before we start medicating. There are some situations where that's, you know, where there's always the exception to the rule, but my general philosophy is I want to give kids the tools that they need. I don't want to start with medication, and I certainly don't want medication to be the only course of treatment.
Well, that's refreshing to hear. We've had guests on before who really decry that kids are diagnosed as ADHD and boom, they're on Ritalin right away and you know, using a drug.
Right.
Well, you know, and that happens with anxiety, too.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's the, you know, the gatekeepers, the physicians who see the kids first, often aren't quite sure what in the world to do with them, and so they do reach for the prescription pad pretty quickly because of lack of options. And so that's part of what we're trying to portray here, that there are things to do. And although Lynn said 4 or 5 months before you get on medication, we're not implying that it actually even takes 4 or 5 months to help a kid or a family turn things around.
Well, let's talk about some of these concrete skills that you're referring to. I know one of the things you advise is not to overly reassure an anxious child, which seems almost counterintuitive. So could you explain that one?
Yeah, it is counterintuitive, and because reassuring a child who's scared or worried is the thing that we most naturally want to do. We want to make them feel safe. We want to make them feel comfortable. Anxiety wants certainty and comfort. That's its agenda. And when we reassure, when we step in and we externally reassure a child who's worried about something, we do two things. One is that we don't allow them to learn how to internally reassure themselves. So we don't allow them to develop the internal dialogue that says, well, let me figure out how to handle this, or I'm going to be able to get through this. And then the other thing that we do is we give them the message that they're not really able to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, a kid says, are you going to pick me up after school? You're going to be there at 3? What happens if you don't show up? And mom says, yeah, I'll be there at 3. Well, are you sure? Yeah, I'll be there at 3. Well, what if you don't show up? Well, call me on my cell phone. Well, what if you forget to charge your cell phone? It becomes this bottomless pit of reassurance. And as the parent just continues to reassure and give information and give information, the child never gets the opportunity to say, how would I handle it if mom didn't show up? What do I have inside of me? What are the resources that I have that will enable me to solve this problem?
Well, I want to take this a little further. Let's take an 8-year-old mm-hmm. whose mother's supposed to pick them up at 3. And they don't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that 8-year-old, what kind of tools should that 8-year-old have if they're healthy and adjusted to deal with that?
Well, the difference might be if you have a child who's not anxious, then you give the plan to them once and they go, oh, okay, good, thanks, Mom.
Go back to the principal's office.
Right. You go find your teacher. And the anxious kid is always looking for that catastrophic thing that's going to happen. What if, the worst case scenario. Well, if your mom doesn't show up, then you go find an adult or you go to the principal's office. A kid who isn't anxious will say, oh, okay, thanks, and then feel competent to be able to carry out the plan. An anxious kid says, well, what if I go to the principal's office and she's not there? Or what if I try and find my teacher and my teacher left early for the day?
Right.
They keep going and going. They don't know how to close that loop.
Okay. So, Bonnie, your question is something we want to clarify, which is it's not about anxious kids not knowing what to do when mom or dad doesn't show up on time. It's anxious kids not even having that problem, worrying that it might occur. Most anxious kids will do just like normal kids, is they'll figure out to go call someone or ask another parent to go to the principal's office. It's this could happen. This could happen. You know, this is the
right.
Malignant disease of the what ifs.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to address.
Let's take a telephone call or two. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Or if you're a little anxious, you can email us at radio@WLRN.org.
We're short of time.
First, we have George in Miami. Hi.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to say it was a very good guest speaker, very, very great topic. I wanted to talk from the standpoint that I actually went through this myself. My parents were extremely anxious parents, and they were the exact definition of you guys to find in the show. Unfortunately, you know, after you become independent, you know, things continue, you know, and things don't really heal. All the push and pull that you go through between the ages when you're really young until you're independent, they'll go away. So So I wanted to ask, what? Hello?
Yes, you're still on.
Oh yeah, thank you. I just wanted to ask, how do you deal with it after? How do you mend relationship with your parents? Because I've actually, we've tried to go to, you know, a therapist, and the therapist told my parents, hey, you know, you guys should let go, and it just, they completely disregarded the therapist, so they're very reluctant to any outside help. What do you do? What do you do after?
So, George, I'm not clear about what's happening now that you're complaining about with your parents.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that my parents were very anxious parents, and they're very, you know, inducing fear, and hey, you can't do this, you can't do that. And what happened was, after, you know, the process of being independent, I'm not 25, caused a lot of strains in the relationship, because I wanted to be independent, but they wanted to shelter me. But even after, now that I'm independent, those, you know, arguments and fights and strains in the relationship with the parents, you know, that they're still there. How do you deal with that? How do you go back and say, hey, you know, maybe you guys are a little tough, or maybe you should have done this? How do you go about it? How do you mend relationships?
Well, yeah, it's an excellent question to be asking. I'm not quite sure we can fix what's happened in the past, but, you know, we start with in the present, which is, as your parents begin to start to intrude in your life again, you just need to set up a boundary with that. You can do it just as lightly as you are able and with as good humor as possible. Mom, thank you so much, but I'm not seven anymore. I'm actually 25. And begin to set some limits in that way. It sounds like it's possible that they still engage you in a kind of argument about one thing or another. And that's where I would begin, is to kind of let go of the rope of trying to prove anything to your parents or make sure you're right and they're wrong, but just let go of that and begin to, you know, if you need to, you have to set limits and just not tell your parents about some of the things that you're doing that they would think would be too frightening. The stuff that's left over from the past, you know, there's psychotherapy for people. That is why families sometimes sit together even when the kids are in their mid-20s to work through some of those past issues.
All right,
well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling, George.
Okay, George, thank you.
I'm just wondering if a child is anxious, I mean, just makes me think with George saying how he had so much anxiety as a kid or had anxious parents, does an anxious child always become an anxious adult, or can they outgrow their anxiety?
Well, we know that if an anxiety disorder, if a kid is really anxious and doesn't get any help and doesn't get any skills, there's a really good chance that they're going to be an anxious adult. And it, even more importantly, perhaps, particularly with teenagers, is that there's a very good likelihood that they'll become depressed as well. Anxiety precedes depression, and people get depressed about being anxious. So do kids with real anxiety disorders grow out of it? Not generally. If they get treatment and if they get some skills, and by treatment it could even be mom or dad reading a book or going to a class and learning and changing their style of things, we know that they don't necessarily have to carry these anxious patterns into adulthood or into their teenage years. But left on its own, the problem is that anxious behaviors are so reinforcing. Avoidance works like a charm, and if you continue to avoid and you stay in that pattern, it becomes sort of your style, then the anxiety is just usually gets stronger over time.
There's an old Jerry Seinfeld thing where he says that Americans were polled and their greatest fear was public speaking. Their second greatest fear was death, so he says they'd rather be in the coffin than giving the eulogy.
And actually, I remember hearing some statistic where they said that more than the majority of people who have a fear of public speaking said they'd rather die than get in front of a crowd. So he's telling the truth.
Let's go back to our phones. This is Judy in Biscayne Park. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hi. I'm a therapist, and I teach people with disabilities to drive. And I often have to deal with kids with ADD and other disabling problems, and very, very commonly they have issues with anxiety, and very, very commonly they have hovering parents that don't allow them to make decisions, yet they expect that these kids are, going to get in the car and be able to decide when to turn into traffic and when not to. So it's, you know, it's just a very difficult thing for me to deal with. And it's really nice to have this book. I'm certainly going to go get it.
It sounds like you could give
it.
Yeah. Did you hear what she said?
No.
She said that she hoped they paid you a lot.
Never enough. But it's amazing how the parents shelter them and they tell them, go now, don't go, da-da. And then the kids get in the car with me and they just sit there and they sit there and they sit there and they don't want to make the decisions for themselves. And
this is, you know, Judy's talking about exactly what we're talking about. The parents are backseat drivers about everything in life under, you know, the guise is I'm trying to take care of my child. So they're,
right.
The motive is a righteous one. It's a decent one, but the strategy is a poor one. And so often it comes out of their own anxieties. When I've been anxious as a child and now I'm an adult, I don't want my child to experience it like I did, so I'm going to go take care of them so that they don't hurt. And it's a mistake.
You know, I'm sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I try to make a habit of bringing the parents in the car once the kids are starting to gain control. And sometimes I'll look in my rearview mirror and I'll notice that the parent in the back seat actually has their eyes closed.
Maybe you need to have copies of the book in the back seat.
I think I'm going to do that.
Do you have to sometimes...
You know, we say that sometimes with the parents, you know, whatever you're feeling inside yourself as your child is about to do, you know, some task that seems really dangerous, try to just have an expression of acceptance and calmness on your face. Don't show that to the child.
Hmm.
Okay, Judy, thanks.
Thank you, Judy. You know, we had an author of a book on how our unconscious mind rules our behavior on a few months ago, and his mother was a Holocaust survivor. And I asked him about how her fear had affected his life, and he said it affected his life greatly. So can parents, even with awareness, pass on these anxieties to their children, even when they do their best not to?
Yes, I think that would be a very good example of that. I think what we coach parents to do is to be pretty upfront with their children about what the family is trying to accomplish. So, you know, we use a lot of humor. Reed and I are, you know, we take our work seriously, but we're very playful. And part of what I want to do with families is to be able to talk about it openly. We want to externalize the anxiety. We want to give it a name. We can create a character for it. And the whole family then can talk very openly about the anxiety ruling the family. I will say to families, the anxiety is like a cult leader. And when everyone's in the cult and listening to the anxiety, no one really understands how powerful it is, but we've got to step back away from it. So using the externalization, giving it a name, using a sense of humor, some playfulness with it, allows parents and kids to talk about it much more openly and not take it so seriously.
Mm.
And that helps a lot.
Right.
What about the anxiety with the what we're reading about all the time, the social media bullying that goes on? How does a parent get involved there?
Lynn, you should answer that.
Okay, I will.
You're a bullying expert, so I'm not.
Right. Well, and one of the things that's interesting, I was just doing some bullying talks with a bunch of third and fourth and fifth graders in one of the towns up here in New Hampshire. The amount of access that kids are getting to things like Facebook and cell phones has increased dramatically in the last 4 or 5 years. One study showed that 50% of girls by the age of 12 have smartphones, and about 49% of them by the age of 10 are using Facebook regularly. So they certainly have access to that kind of stuff. I think what I tell kids and what I tell parents is that it really takes a lot of communication and a lot of talking with kids about what's appropriate and what's not. The problem with the social media stuff is that it gives kids permission to do things from a distance that they would never do face-to-face. The good news is that all of the education that we've been doing with kids about cyberbullying seems to be working, particularly in the primary grades. we've got a lot of kids that are saying that they were a bully once, but it felt so uncomfortable and it felt so wrong to them that they would never do it again. And that's the kind of stuff that researchers are looking for, kids being able to feel that sense of morality when they're doing something mean that they wouldn't do face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So parents need to keep an eye on things. I have two teenagers myself, and it's tough. The other thing, though, the flip side of that is that because of the technology, it gives parents the impression and even the ability to be much more intrusive in their kids' lives than they really should be. So there's that fine balance, mm-hmm. too. Parents shouldn't know everything that their child is doing and shouldn't be privy to every conversation that a child is having with their friends. That's too intrusive and too controlling. So we walk this fine line of giving them their independence but also wanting to pay attention to what goes on online, which can be pretty scary.
And we go back to the phones. We have Isabella in Miami. Hi.
Yes. Hi. Sorry, let me take you off of... Hi, I'm an anxious parent of a five-month-old baby, and I'm hoping you guys can give me some pointers as to how to avoid creating an anxious child.
And what do you mean when you say you're an anxious parent?
I have a very low risk tolerance. I like to avoid risk when I can. Growing up, my mom was sick always, and I think fearing losing her created a lot of anxiety. I feel anxious about a lot of things, and just listening to all of your comments about wanting to control every aspect really rang true to me, and I'm hoping to avoid it.
And are you a single parent, or do you have a partner involved?
No, I have a partner, and he is the opposite of me. He's very comfortable with risk, and I think that makes me even
See,
more
well, so that's the good news. And, you know, the bad news is that very often the anxious parent will kick the risk taker parent out of the system, you know. So if the if the husband says, we'll say for this example, you know, it's fine to let her go ahead and start walking the five blocks to school. She's 12 years old. If the anxious parent then says, okay, fine. If she gets kidnapped, then it's on you. You know, I'm just going to let you do. Go ahead. That's fine. And so when the anxious parent starts saying that to the more risk-tolerant parent, that risk-tolerant parent, you know, throws up his hands and says, all right, I'll just let you control things. It's not worth it to me. So they get ostracized. So keeping your partner involved here, I mean, here you are talking to us when you have a five-month-old saying, I'm an anxious parent, is exactly what you want to be. You know, it's a good sign that you already recognize that. We were talking earlier about people not recognize it. Bonnie was asking that question. So, you know, one, that you're recognizing, and second, that you're going to try to be, you know, just like all of us, you're going to be protecting your child all the way through until they're, you know, I've got a 25-year-old and a 30-year-old, and if I see them cry, I want to make them, I want to get them to stop crying. So you're going to be, you know, dealing with this in a normal way anyway. So just keep your partner involved here and start looking at the times and places when you start to hesitate, and you check in with your partner or a friend and ask their opinion about those decisions. I think that's the best way to do it. And then there's a nice new book out that you might want to read. Prophylactically.
Shameful.
And I think, too, Isabella, is that I think that you're going to really want to, as I was saying, sort of not listen to anxiety as the cult leader. You're going to really want to be able to recognize when your anxious voice steps up and starts bossing you around. And so being able to differentiate between what's good common sense of parenting and when is that anxiety coming in and stepping up and being in charge. So it's that same skill of being able to externalize your anxiety a little bit. And I think what Reed said cannot be overemphasized, listening to the people in your life who are not anxious to give you a little bit of a reality check sometimes is going to be enormously helpful to you.
I will try my best. The funny thing is that the only thing my husband is anxious about seems to be my child, our child. Oh.
Well, then you can both read the book together.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
And we'll move along. This is Don. He's in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Is that me?
That's you.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah, well, great. I'm really enjoying this this discussion. This is something that's been central in my life for a number of years. I have twin girls that suffer from anxiety in very, very seemingly different ways. They're 24 years old. They're twins. And one of them took the initiative. I divorced their mother when they were 16. They lived with me. The mother moved out. And I guess they may have developed some anxiety as a result of that, but I'm no analyst, so I can't say for sure. But they both came out different ways. One of them is gay, and she just, a couple of years ago, she just had enough of living with her mother. She had moved out of my house when she was grown up, about 22, lived with her mother for a couple of years, drove her out of her mind, and she just split and went to the west coast of the country and is doing excellently, although her social skills are really awful. The other one is still living with the mother and really, really suffering from anxiety and depression. She got Baker acted, the first, all they did was they kept her in a thing, in a psych ward, and ended up giving her a bunch of pills, and I'm not really sure how much that helped. So she's suffering, and I could have this talk for a long, long, long time. So many interesting things you guys are saying. But
what kind of advice can you give, say, Dr. Wilson?
I don't know what the question is yet from Don. Do you have a specific question, Don?
Well, the question is, what can I do for my 24-year-old child who doesn't live with me but goes up and down and up and down? And I'm trying to get her on track. She's having the tremendous issues with staying in college. She's flunked out a number of times. She's can't hold down a job. I don't know. I've tried to get her to sign up for Medicaid. She doesn't follow through. It's like she has the emotional developmental level of a 12-year-old.
We're talking about a complex case here, and so. Self-help advice isn't going to go too far with something as complex. One of the couple of things that Don is illustrating is that what Lynn was saying earlier, when you have an anxious child and they have several episodes of anxiety in their childhood and adolescence, they're far less likely to attend college, to complete college. They're more vulnerable to depression, absolutely. They're more likely to get involved in drugs and alcohol. They're more likely to have conflicts with people openly. So there's a lot of things that are happening with Don's daughter that are pretty common with kids who don't get some help early on. So I think part of where we would go now is to try to find a specialist in anxiety disorders, or let's make sure we get a good diagnosis of what's going on with your daughter, Dawn, to make sure it's, what else besides anxiety is going on. Sounds pretty clear that she also has depression and difficulty maintaining her commitments to school and so forth. So I think that's where we would go next, is to not think that there's going to be some magic pill in a book or a brief piece of advice, but again, we're going to get to this piece of you can bring a horse to water, not get them to drink, and you may have that trouble with your 24-year-old who's not living with you anymore to influence her. You may not be an influencing agent right now, and that's terribly frustrating to you, and I'm sorry that you're struggling with not being able to give her the advice and guidance that you would like to.
Well, we hope that helps, Don. We're speaking with Dr. Reed Wilson. He's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina, and Lynn Lyons. Their book is entitled, and she's a clinical social worker and psychotherapist, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. We'll take a short break and come back with more calls. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking with the co-authors of Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, Dr. Reed Wilson, and Lynn Lyons. And we're going to take more calls. We're going to go to an email first, though. This is Laura. She says, my 16-year-old handles a lot. Crohn's disease, a challenging school schedule, a romantic one-year-old relationship. She doesn't shy away from this, but she does seem to have these breakdowns that are becoming more frequent. We believe to be supporting parents, but try to teach her she needs to handle her feelings and frustrations. My question is, are there hormonal changes that would affect a teen girl's anxiety level throughout her month and teen years, or should we look for help?
Well, I think the simple answer is yes, there's probably hormonal things. If you've been a teenage girl, which this mom has and which I have, you know, things kind of go up and down. It sounds like, though, that what they're doing correctly is they're saying you're staying involved in your life, you're staying involved in your activities. It sounds like this is a pretty capable, competent young woman. And what they want to be on the lookout for is whether or not she starts to step back out of these activities, whether or not there are changes in her grades, in her sleep, whether or not her relationships start to suffer. So if she's having these meltdowns, I'm very solution-oriented, so we want to promote problem-solving. When you're in this situation, what can you do in order to find your way out? Sometimes it's riding the wave of hormonal teenagerhood, but I think that it sounds like this mom is really sort of on the right track of saying, your job, we're here to support you, but your job is to figure out how are you going to manage these challenges as they come up.
And I would just, one thing I would add also, the question came out like, is it this or that? Is it hormonal, or should we help get her some help? And even if the hormonal changes are a significant part of the problem, doesn't mean that we then go, oh, well, it's hormones.
Right.
You still have to address, you know, acting responsibly and taking control of your emotions to the best of your ability.
Okay, Laura. Right. I hope that helps.
And back to our phones, we have Amy. She's in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Amy.
Hi there. So I've been listening for quite a while, and I apologize slightly because I do realize that both the authors aren't local, but there are a lot of people calling locally. And I just wanted to pose a question about affordable services. I'm a therapist also here in South Florida, and I work for a nonprofit. And we provide affordable services throughout the community. But I'm just curious if in the book, or if you guys could maybe talk a little bit about it, because I feel as though sometimes a lot of people calling or emailing could really use these services, and it's hard sometimes to find therapists and people who are, you know, trained or thinking this way like you guys are. And people might hear this and think, you know, this is great, but, and I really do, and I've read this book, and I really need some extra help. Where do I turn? And it's often a problem in our community, I think, sometimes.
What is the process, Lynn?
Yeah.
The process here?
Well, in general, for those who want to have some anxiety treated or at least talk up to somebody about it.
Well, I think, you know, you've got to look at what the resources are in your community, and I feel your pain. In New Hampshire, for example, finding a child psychiatrist is, you know, it's about like finding a unicorn. But I think the most important thing in terms of anxiety treatment, there are a few things. One is that self-help, we know that self-help really does work. It's a great place to start. People who read books, who get solid instruction. The other thing is that if you're dealing with anxiety, finding somebody who works with anxiety disorders in particular is absolutely more efficient than finding somebody who doesn't. That's where the trick comes in. I know, Reed, you can talk more with the Anxiety Disorders Association of America has a website that people can go to and find people who specialize, correct?
And what
That's
is,
right.
And what is that website?
The address is adaa.org, and there is a way for them to search in Miami or Fort Lauderdale or whatever city they're in, 5, 10, 15 miles away. Now you're going to get, 10 or 15 people who are specialists in anxiety, and then, as Amy's talking about, you're going to have to talk to them about sliding scale, can I afford your services? The other thing that some communities have, and maybe the Miami-Fort Lauderdale area has it too, is self-help groups.
and support groups that are run by a variety of organizations. There's another one called the International OCD Foundation. That's for people with obsessive compulsive disorder. And they also have a referral service that you can log on their website and look for someone. So you do have to be an educated consumer, and what Amy's talking about is a terribly frustrating thing, and what Lynn's talking about too. One is it can be very expensive if you have no insurance, and second is if you don't work with somebody who understands anxiety disorders, you can get stuck in a treatment that is not productive. Mm. And the most important thing to be looking for when you're working with a therapist and you're trying to work on anxiety is, are they giving you homework? You should always have homework. So not talking about your past and your parents and so forth, but what are we doing this, you know, what are we going to do between this session and the next time? And we don't, with kids, keep it secret and private from parents. We try to have the parents included in the homework assignments, that it's a family work and not just working with the kids. The research is quite clear. If you have an anxious parent and an anxious child and you only treat the child in therapy, they get about a 33% success rate. If you include the parent in parent education and training, it moves up to 80% success rate. So it's very dramatic.
Well, we're a little short on time.
Well, we'll have a link to the ADAA.org on our website. And do you have websites for the book?
We do, and the website is called playingwithanxiety.com.
Playing with anxiety.
We have a free kids book on the website. You can go to the website, download it. It's a significant book just for the kids. There's no cost whatsoever for it. So it's playingwithanxieties.com.
Okay, we'll have a link. Dr. Reed Wilson and Lynn Lyons, Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to, including Frank and Jennifer. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. And tomorrow's program looks at the increase of hearing loss. 17% of Americans suffer from it, and there are psychological and family burdens incurred. We have free audio archives and downloads of our programs at WLRN website. That's WLRN.org. And more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And the calendar on this day, 1920, 84 years ago, the birth of actor Jack Palance in Pennsylvania. With a 50-year film and TV career, he won an Oscar in 1991 for City Slickers. He was Marlon Brando's understudy in Streetcar on Broadway. And on this day in 1957, 57 years ago, the birth of game show queen Vanna White in Conway, South Carolina. She became a household name on Wheel of Fortune. One more while we sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. On this day in 1998, 16 years ago, the death of baseball announcer Harry Carey. He worked Cardinals, A's, White Sox, and Cubs games. Holy cow! And we leave with a thought from Harry Carey, who attended the same St. Louis Elementary School as I did. Not at the same time, though. Quote from Harry, "I don't know what the big deal about Cracker Jack is. Did you ever go buy a pack of Cracker Jack thinking you'd get a prize and find no prize in the box? Here's the pitch." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from Where Else But NPR News.